It's a joy to finally meet the retreatants who are here. And I suppose proper etiquette, if that still exists in the world, mandates that I should apologize for my not greeting you when you first arrived. But of course, we also know that everything that happens, happens exactly according to the will of God as it must unfold. And this machine here has a double function in the ashram. One is to minister to the Sangha, and the other is to administer the ashram and its many projects and many different activities. And at the end of a year, especially this year, the administration requires humongous numbers of difficult decisions to make, and that requires meetings and requires direction and redirection and all kinds of backstage activities that don't permit me necessarily come on stage for my primary function. But the primary function is simply to transmit truth of a non-ordinary kind that enables those who grok the complete knowledge to pass beyond the barriers of ego consciousness into union with the Supreme Intelligence. And to do that as quickly and as painlessly and blissfully as can be achieved through the letting go of one's attachments to identification with the bodily machine and its mental apparatus. And the entirety of the knowledge of Sat Yoga can be summed up in simply that proposal to realize that you are not the machine and its mental apparatus, but that who you are now, always, is the Supreme Intelligence, the Infinite Self. And all that has to be done is to let go of the false belief that I refers to a bodily being and an earthbound mind that is concerned with a very limited circle of care and of belief in its potentiality. This was summed up in the teachings of the Trika wisdom school of Kashmir around the 10th century, when they came up with two different concepts of, I think, great relevance, perhaps even more now. The first concept is that we suffer from three malas. Malas are usually interpreted as impurities, but I would just say illusions. And the first mala that we must go beyond to become nirmala, or vimala, which is the goal of yoga, of every wisdom school, actually, is the anava mala. The anava mala, does anyone remember what the anava mala consists of?
Identification with the body.
Yes, identification with the ego operating system of the body. So in other words, if you think you are an individual being, a human functioning as a bodily existent entity, then you are under a delusion. That's not what we are. But once you come under the influence of that mala, then along with that come two others, one of which is the maya mala, meaning the mental apparatus has been pre-programmed with a number of false beliefs and orientations to reality based on that false identification that you were indoctrinated into believing. And those projections and attitudes and belief systems create the third mala, which is the karma mala. It produces glitches in the matrix because there are errors in judgment that arise as a result of those mistaken beliefs, and disappointment, and all too often anxiety and depression and other mental disorders arise that increase one's suffering. And these in turn lead to karma of an external variety that lead to unhappiness in relationships. Then the second set of concepts that they developed, which are in alignment but elaborate a bit on this, is the theory of the five kanchukas. If everyone, I'm sure that those who were here remember those, they are limitations. Once you have fallen into the malas, you are subject to five varieties of limitation, which are really contained in the definition of the malas, but they're elaborated more in this module that was developed by Abhinavagupta in Kashmir in the 10th century. The first one is the limitation of power. There's a limited amount of energy that the body has, a limited amount of power to concentrate, a limited amount of willpower, because in the ego, with its structure, there are always internal conflicts, and the will is divided against itself. And then in the second kanchaka is limited knowledge, incomplete and inaccurate knowledge, both phenomenal plane knowledge, knowledge of the world and its trajectory of unfoldment. We have some knowledge. So, for example, everyone who pays attention to the news knows that the dollar's value is going down every day. But we don't know how long it will take before it crashes to zero. And we don't know if some days it will spike and actually increase in value, because it tends to be on that kind of a wave function. So we don't have complete knowledge, but we have enough knowledge, perhaps, to make mature assessments as to the proper strategy for dealing with a situation of that sort, as well as all of the other kinds of situations that we are faced with, both on an individual and a collective level. And, of course, the other kind of knowledge is the knowledge of liberation from the phenomenal plane. which at the ego level is also incomplete and often inaccurate. And then the third is the pre-programming of the apparatus with a certain set of attachments, loyalties, fears, and desires that we are have been installed in the consciousness for those who are adapted to the social order. And various other drives and tendencies, proclivities, preconceptions that are part of the conscious and subconscious program. And then the fourth akanchaka is that of the fact that external events cannot be controlled. We could call this karma again, but it's a matter of recognizing that we are having to flow with surprises that are always occurring, and that we cannot maintain a particular course without often tacking and shifting strategies and approaches and even paradigms that must shift in order to more adequately understand the unfoldment of events. And then finally, time. There's always a limited amount of time and too many things to do that can't be done in that time. How many of you feel subject to these five conchakas? Okay, so this is what the Buddhists would call dukkha. Now, it's true that this is the case for the machine and for the ego apparatus to some extent, but when we go back to the understanding of knowledge, not all knowledge has to do with surviving and thriving on the phenomenal plane as an individual being. That's a very low sort of knowledge from a yogic perspective. The real knowledge that we want is to recognize that you are not the machine, either the hardware or the software that is its current operating system, but you are the user of the machine and its software, and you have the inherent power to upgrade the software so that you can increase your knowledge. Both knowledge of the phenomenal and knowledge of the noumenal, the transcendent, the real. So the paths of the various wisdom schools tend to offer two approaches to the question of liberation. In the non-dual schools, those who say that the ultimate real that will be arrived at is not simply that of a soul who outlives the body and may be reborn and has its own trajectory of lifetimes and may go into bardo states after the death of the body, etc., but there's a level beyond that of a supreme, the supreme, and only intelligence that is the real self of every being, every soul and every ego. The real self of every lesser self is this one supreme self. And that is who I, the word I, really refers to for everyone. And so the two approaches that tend to develop are adaptations to the limitations of the belief systems of the beings who come to study and undergo a process of transformation, because there are some whose imagination cannot comprehend or aspire to the realization of that non-dual self that is the self of the cosmos. But they can grok the possibility of being a soul relating to God and having a relation of devotion in which they can receive the grace of God. And so if one is in that frame of reference in which one is comfortable with a relation to the Supreme Being, however that is conceptualized, whether that's the Buddha nature, Brahman, Allah, the Tao, the mother of the 10,000 things, the great goddess, Parashakti, whatever is the concept that one has, the relationship, as it develops and becomes more felt as not only a love for that being that one does not know, which is a mystery to the ego, but one begins to feel a response to one's prayers and one's meditations, a reception perhaps of Shakti, of power, of a sense of good fortune and of providence opening up new possibilities that emerge as synchronicities in one's unfoldment of life, then the sense of feeling a real relationship develops the bhava into mahabhava, into a kind of a great feeling of devotion and adoration. And that adoration can lead to one of two things. Well, it leads to both, but the first focus is often on the purification of the ignorance. In other words, the ego mind is ignorance. That's all it is. It's complete lack of true knowledge of reality. And it often has tendencies that are that create such negative karma that one cannot meditate. It produces internal anxiety and or sleepiness or inability to remain in a state of silent adoration and receive the power that purifies the consciousness at the level of the ego. But the purification is intended to eliminate vices, to eliminate those habits, those patterns of living which are deregulated and which create suffering and which cause perhaps an inability to sustain love relationships, to sustain psychological and spiritual growth, to sustain one's projects of development of one's capacity to concentrate and to know oneself in whatever way. If those are too obstructive, then one tends to be given by traditional teachers things like asanas to do and pranayamas, breath work, those kinds of things to calm the body down and to bring one into a more peaceful state so that the deeper levels of concentration can begin to happen in meditation and one can remain awake and aware but without being filled with mental chatter. And so the purification of the ego is basically the goal, is to release one from that compulsive chatter so that the mind can become silent and in the silence perceive and feel the presence of that supreme intelligence that is one's expanded self, one's true nature, that transcends the life of the body and of the body's mental apparatus and even of the soul. But there is also another approach that the wisdom schools have developed, which is to, for those who are ready for it, to say, we can skip purifying the ego because that could go on for years and years. The ego may have many sanskaras that are problematic. If one is able to grok, to really receive and understand and retain the truth that you are not the ego, that what you are is pure awareness and intelligence that is using the body but is not at all identified with it. And if you can let go of your attachment to the body and to the ego's attachments, and if you can let go of that tendency of mental chatter and master the mind so that you remain in silence at will, then the moment you transcend the event horizon of ego consciousness and you reach that total silence, you realize liberation is your true state. And there's no process. There's nothing that has to be gone through, because the silence itself is ego death. It's the annihilation, the vanishing, the disappearance of identity as a being in the world and the natural realization of one's true nature as the dreamer of the world. So those who are ripe and ready for instant liberation, we are designed to be able to achieve that. But to do that, you need to have two kinds of knowledge accurately grokked. I use that word because it's more than simply symbolic understanding or understanding of an intellectual kind. But one kind of knowledge is conceptual knowledge of the truth to the extent that language can express it and point to it. If you do not have that accuracy of understanding who you are and who you are not, then that misunderstanding will bring you back into the ego. So there does have to be a capacity for coherent thought that is capable of thinking your way out of the ego. But that kind of knowledge alone opens the portal, but it won't get you through it. What is required is knowledge of the real, knowledge in the real, knowledge as the real. So there must be a taste of that supreme bliss, of that light of lights, of that absolute self, such that you know it by being it, even if only momentarily, but enough to return to it and abide in that state through the recognition that that is who I am. And if one receives that knowledge that is the supreme real and can protect it with the symbolic understanding that that's the case, because otherwise if you just have an experience or an imperience of the light or of that consciousness that is absolute because of momentary circumstances or the taking of some drug, or you are in some altered state because of a situation or a practice that brought you to it momentarily, you won't hold it if you don't also have the conceptual knowledge in place to ward off the ego's tendency to turn it into a narrative, to turn it into a story that one tells other people at the next party of, oh, I went through ego death in that last ayahuasca trip, and now I'm, you know, but it just that the ego has come back and simply makes a fiction out of what was true. Because the ego, that's all it does, is create fictions. And so one has to have reached it in such an attitude of completion of one's desire to remain as an ego in the world without any further karmic desires that haven't been satisfied, without any further need to experience oneself as a psychological entity. And once that capacity to silence the mind has become thoroughgoing, so that there are no sanskaras, no tendencies, no impulses to start the chattering engine up again, but to abide in the emptiness, then the fullness of the presence of God consciousness is given as the grace that completes the journey. So this is the different branchings of sadhana that one finds oneself drawn to on one's own path. And each being has to determine for oneself what is the most accurate path that can be effective in reaching the attainment of the self. And for most, it is a combination of the use of adoration, love, and the realization of I am, and the power of a sustained will to be in an unconditional state of consciousness that is internally free of any bondages of desire or fear or of beliefs. And so when the mind is completely free of any conditionings, then that freedom itself enables the creative intelligence of the Supreme Self to flow through the machinery of the body and the mind, and for the consciousness to be free of any concern for the outcome or of any sense of otherness. And there is both a state of being no one and a state of being all that are the same. So that's a summary of our process and of our approach. And I really have no other teaching that I think is needed to be offered this evening, but we have time, and so I'd like to open the floor to anyone who has a question or a comment, and there's a microphone in the back. So whoever wishes, just go to the mic and ask a question or make any observations you wish or contribute as you would like to the Sangha. Particularly the retreatants, I hope you're not shy. I don't think any of you are. And if there's anyone who has trouble walking to the mic, let's bring a mic to that person if they ask for it.
Namaste.
I'm going to get my glasses out so I can actually see who's up there.
Thank you for this teaching. It's always good to remember why we're here and what the journey is, if there is even a journey. But one thing that I thought was really interesting is when you said that in the second one, the knowledge of the real, on that path of the knowledge of the real, that if one is given, receives a knowledge, one is given the knowledge, the grace, momentarily, one needs the conceptual knowledge to ward off the ego's machinations. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if you could please speak more to that, this conceptual knowledge that is needed to constantly fight, let's say, the ego's machinations.
It's not constant. It's just long enough to establish your sense of who you are as the infinite self, not the finite particular being that had been identified with, right? But as long as there hasn't been the total purification of all the sanskaras of the ego, sanskaras are those tendencies to grab you. They are encoded desires to continue the thinking process in order to achieve certain ends that the ego has been programmed to want and also to run away from. And so as long as some of those remain, even latent or subconsciously, then they will try to grab you back from the light and back into the world and convince you that, you know, you had a minor hallucinatory event of liberation, but it wasn't real, or, you know, it may take years for it to happen again, or whatever. A narrative will ensue that will bring one back into the earthbound level of the consciousness until one has that knowledge that can immediately recognize the falsehood of the ego's narrative and have and be able to refute it, do dharma combat with your own ego, and to then silence it and remain in that state where one is done with all narratives.
So an example of this would be, for instance, when one is in silence and suddenly one realizes that one is thinking or putting down whatever the impurities that one had. I mean, there's chatter happening. And one of the first things to do is, of course, to understand that you don't believe any of the words that are being right now heard or perceived, because that's the ego precisely working on its machination on bringing you back down. And so that would be a question. And the second one is, this is also true for the different stages in the gradual path. If one is on the gradual path, that one should apply this knowledge to deconstruct.
Well, yes, of course one should. But the difficulty is, until you have removed the core belief in the I thought itself, as long as the sense of I is operating at a plane of representation, then you will be ruled by language, because the attachment to language is so deep, so embedded in the ego itself, that it doesn't have control over its ability to not only stop thinking, but even to recognize that the thoughts that are happening are not its own, but are alien implants from the other out there. And because it can't recognize that, and it assumes when a thought comes up, I am wanting to eat dinner, it assumes that that means yourself, and you make the body do it, rather than realizing, wait a minute, I am not really hungry at all. This was just a habitual reaction because the clock said it was a certain time or whatever. And one has the ability to say, no, actually, I'm not really hungry, and I won't do that. But the capacity to second guess your own thoughts is something that develops as you rise up the ladder. But the level I'm talking about is when there is, in fact, a disidentification from the I thought itself. That's when it will make its last-ditch effort to try to grab you. In the lower stages, it's much more difficult to stop the mental chatter. Because one is the I is still identified as an artifact of the program rather than the user of the program. So until that shift is made from ego to soul consciousness, the willpower to stop the mind and to recognize that it's not your own actual drive that is making those thoughts appear will not be clearly perceivable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the question. It's a good question.
Thank you for this teaching. Yeah. I'm not a retreatant, but I am a bit shy. So
you're a retreatant. You're on a long-term retreat.
Yeah. So this machine will persevere.
But, great.
Yeah, something really resonated about the two distinctions that you made, that you can, there's the purification of your ignorance, I think mm-hmm. you had said,
mm-hmm.
or misunderstanding, something like that, mm-hmm. and then there's the instant grokking that you're not the I,
mm-hmm.
that you're not the like the ego mechanism. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of, first question is like, can there be like a combination of the two? Because I think the first one you mentioned that there's glitches that can kind of prevent you from perpetually growing.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's the gradual path, and most people have no choice but to take that. In the sense that there isn't that full recognition and readiness for transcendence. You know, others, it's always grace. It's not the will of the individual that actually enables the instant liberation to happen. It hits like a lightning bolt from the real and dissolves the illusion. It doesn't happen from the ignorant ego mind itself. But it happens when there is a sufficient ripeness that developed through bhakti, through devotion and yearning for that, and study of one's understanding of reality, so that one, even at the ego level, is convinced that it's true. And now one's trying to figure out, well, how do I silence this mind? Mm-hmm. And that's when that will often happen.
Okay. And so I feel like I'm probably not the only one here, but I've had the fortunate gift of like really witnessing the extent of my inner quagmire or or mud swamp, whatever you want to call it. Like mm-hmm. just
that's
that,
a good term for it.
That thick, goopy place. And it's definitely related to language.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's definitely something kind of anti-life that's been like kind of somatized as like just a heavy like, you know, and
yeah, it's true. The ego is a crippler of life, because life is joy, life is creativity, but the ego is in a state of feeling it's lacking, it's not good enough, it's not this enough, it's not right. And so it can't feel joy. Mm-hmm. It feels like it doesn't deserve joy, it's not capable of it, it can't sustain it, it's got work to do, and it's not allowed to be too happy. You know, it's been trained to not know its true nature, which is great, joyous creative power to act in ways that are totally unpredictable and completely free of any constraints of any doctrines or belief systems or of the rules and laws of society, etc. There has to be that total freedom, but freedom not for the ego to act out, because then you would be dealing with a criminal desire, but freedom from the ego in order for one's genius to fully manifest and to feel the joy of the fulfillment of the ability to express the deepest feelings in your heart in a work of art or a work of raising a child, or a work of any sort of creativity whatsoever that one is called to, because life itself becomes a work of art when the consciousness is free.
Thank you. That really connects.
And that'll dry up your mud lot.
Nice. Kind of connecting with this, like the joy, like it feels like there's a wakefulness that kind of comes with
becoming
joyful, and actually like not having that anti-life part where you actually become awake to life totally. And like I've noticed kind of something related to the whole idea that we're supposed to sleep for 8 hours and this whole mentality about sleep and needing enough rest. But then like something related to that, I think one of the main glitches that's kind of led to more glitches on that first path of purification has been like napping and tuning out is like something that's really a core structure to like this ego system. And so like tuning out and having to like take naps and it seems like a part of like this anti-life thing, but like it became like to a point where like the mind was very like clear and could get very silent, but I just kept falling asleep and like just knocking out every single meditation. And it was like, what is it? Is there something unbearable still, or is a wrong dynamic that, or?
No, the ego is designed to prevent you from escaping it. And so if it can't do it with chatter, it'll do it by putting you to sleep. Or it'll make you just lose interest in the process, or lose belief in it, and become cynical, etc. So no, that the ego has a design to keep your consciousness captive, and serving it rather than being the servant of the real self. So that's what has to be overcome. And when you fully realize that the ego's thoughts and its tendencies to fall asleep are not because you're actually tired on a body level, it's a tamasic defense mechanism against the infinite self, because it's terrified of infinity, because it will dissolve. The ego will no longer have the illusion of existing. You will be free. And so it's freedom that terrifies it. Okay?
Thank you.
But go into that state of freedom from thought, and you discover its bliss. And if you stay in it long enough, you will never want to leave it. Okay? And then you win, and the ego will have no power to seduce you back into sleep and anti-life tendencies. But the anti-life tendency was originally an anti-love tendency because of anger at toxic love that was given to you, or neglect, or traumas in childhood that produced a sense of alienation from the caregivers, and a sense of being adored and loved unconditionally. And so those anti-life tendencies then developed into a kind of rebelliousness that turned into rebelling against your own best interests, and of both falling asleep when you really want to be awake. So it's rebelling against your own desire to be free from those tendencies, and it produces a kind of ongoing projection of anger and blame, and of a sense of a paranoid relationship with others, right? Because then love can't come out. So love and life are very closely linked, and when there's anti-one, there's anti-the-other. But what you want is the love that is the source of joy, but it's love not for an object and not the love of a subject. It's love in itself, because that's the nature of God.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce.
Okay, a question from Anuradha. As you were speaking of the two types of knowledge for those who are ripe and ready for liberation, I curiously started coughing to clear the tickle in my throat. took a drink of water, unwrapped a cough drop, and as you continued by saying the words knowledge of the real, in the real, as the real, it got really bad. I couldn't sit here and just listen. I had to write or keep the body-mind busy. I've also been having this trouble at night, been having trouble sleeping again, so I tune into your teachings, mostly the meditations, and this tickle is unsurpassable, painful, and made me slightly angry the other night, and so I calmly got out of bed and found something to do, like folding clothes. But I was wondering if you could use the sword of reason for this one and what you would have to share.
Well, yes, it's clearly there is a subconscious fragment of your ego that does not want you to reach that supreme real and makes you uncomfortable whenever you begin to approach it and to recognize consciously that it is who you are and it's possible to be free of the ego. It will create a symptom that will be so distracting and so uncomfortable that you will begin to focus on that rather than on the supreme reality. So I would use both a sense of humor and a soothing of this ego that's terrified that you're going to escape and be free and it's going to die. And the original birth trauma of being abandoned is now what the ego is feeling as your soul is threatening to abandon it and reach bliss and leave it, you know, all alone with its suffering. That's a fantasy, of course, but that would be probably the kind of delusion that is creating this symptomatology. If you are able to soothe it a bit and calm it with love and not with rejection, because the ego was rejected, and this will counter that feeling, and at the same time, detachment and the recognition that the power of love that you are giving is not coming from the ego, but is coming from the real self. And then entering into the heart while remaining giving the grace of peace to that part that is terrified that you're going to leave, then that part will receive the grace of being lifted up into the absolute and dissolving in the light rather than feeling like it will be left behind. And then I think you can overcome these kinds of symptoms occurring as you approach the electric fence of freedom from the ego's past history and its fears. Okay, I hope that was useful to you, Anuradha.
Then a question from Ute. What is meant by the plane of representation and the superposition that you so often talk about? Could you please elaborate more on this?
Well, they're two different concepts. The plane of representation occurs once you acquire language. And then everything you perceived is perceived through a grid of words. And there's a whole science of semiotics and linguistics that have developed in modern and postmodern philosophy that has actually come to a very deep understanding of how that plane operates, how we got trapped on it, and even what is the way out of it. So the plane of representation is sustained by the mental chatter that is constantly going on. And to use let's say, a Lacanian psychoanalytic terminology that I think may clarify it, Lacan divided the I into two levels. I think we need to actually say it's three, but he said we have the I of the enunciation and the I of the statement. What that means is, there is a part of you that before you speak to someone, you begin to have to formulate a thought on the plane of representation. But that thought is not fully formulated, and there is a certain amount of freedom from knowing what you're going to say until it's actually said and the statement is made, right? And at that level of the eye of enunciation, there is just enough free will and a time lag that one could alter what one says. It doesn't often happen, and that's why there are such things as Freudian slips, where you say what you wish you hadn't said and didn't mean to say. But the eye of the enunciation has a slight degree of freedom. Behind that, the yogis, I think, would all agree that there is an eye of pure awareness. Okay? Now, again, to go back to the Trika Wisdom School, they divide it into four levels. So you have the level of let's say, the archetypal vision of possibilities of what could be expressed. Then you have that coming into thought, and then it being expressed in words and actions. And a level on top of that, which is the absolute freedom beyond even any archetypal possibilities of the imaginal level of consciousness producing a certain outcome. So, but if we just start with a simpler version of the eye of the awareness, that eye has no identity, because it's not yet on the plane of representation. Once you make a statement, let's say, to go back to what I'd said earlier, I'm going to have dinner, I'm hungry, I want to do this, or I want to take a walk, or there's something, you have identified with the body that will act. You're no longer identified with the mind. And so the representation has now become the gross level of action. So René Descartes, who's like the founder of modern philosophy back in the 1600s in France, he said that cogito ergo sum, the famous phrase, I think, therefore I am. He could not have said, I'm eating dinner, therefore I am. Or I'm going to take a walk, therefore I am. Because you could be fooled into having a dream where you were eating dinner or taking a walk, or hallucinating it, or hallucinating something else, and it wasn't really happening. But you could not deny the fact that you were having that thought. Okay? So, but in fact, even the thought turns out not to be your own. It's not you having the thought is having you. So you have to go back to the eye of awareness that is free of thought to reach a point where there is absolute indubitable being, right? Because you could always be fooled by a deceptive idea or delusion at those other levels. If you can stay in that eye of awareness, you can reprogram the eye that speaks and the one that thinks. But until you have reached that level of differentiation and realize you are different from who you think you are and from who others think you are because of how you behave. If you are free of those identifications and projective identifications, then you have a sufficient margin of freedom to alter the role that the character you have been playing is playing, and its functions, its goals, its its whole frame of reference. But that freedom does not exist within the other levels. So the plane of representation is the ignorance of the fact that you are not the I that appears in thought or in actual vocalized words. But most people have not come to the clear awareness that they are not the one who thinks, that that I is an artifact of programming. I hope that clarifies it. The question of superposition, well, that has many different levels to it, because there's quantum superposition, there's the superposition of the quantum waves and the qualium waves. I won't go into all that, but in relation to what I was just saying, there's a superposition of what I perceive and what I project. At the ego level, one assumes that one is seeing reality as it is. One thinks one's common sense is telling you the truth about reality. That's a very naive attitude. When you realize that there is another level of uncommon sense that can recognize your projections and others' projections and see that everyone is actually living in their own delusional ignorance of what is really happening because they're subject to their programming, then you have the ability to think coherently, finally. And it's only when you can think coherently that you can remove these incoherent superimpositions of projections upon the field of the explicate order, and then perceive it from a deeper and deeper place, ultimately beyond even time and space and the unfoldment of the linear succession of moments of time, and recognize the eternal within the temporal. Okay, I guess. If there's nobody in the room who wants to ask anything, go ahead.
Okay, question from Bryant. How can we reconcile our own attainment of being the light that transcends the event horizon of ego consciousness with loved ones or family members who may still be living in a lower consciousness?
When you're in that state, you won't see them in a lower consciousness. You will see everyone as a manifestation of God, and there will be unconditional love. But love without attachment, love without projection, love without any of the egoic deceptions that are meant to buffer and deny aspects of the ways that the egos of those others are interfering with the potential for creative collaboration and mutual enhancement that enables all to benefit from your realization of the light, and for them to also realize that there is no difference between who they are and who you are. And it's that ability to penetrate through that barrier to reach that place of sameness that others can relate to and let go of some of their defenses, so that love flows without the superimposition of those negative tendencies, will enhance one's life with those beings, and also give them the freedom to separate and go their own way when that is appropriate. Okay. Any of our visitors have a question tonight? Last chance. No. Okay. Parvati, okay.
I'm a visitor.
You're a visitor, yeah.
Thank you for the teaching. I actually really have been reflecting more or what impacted me was in the beginning, and you opened up explaining how you're both a minister and an ad minister. That led me in a couple directions. One is I feel like I do a lot of that kind of just work, right? Like I can do karma yoga, but there is this lack and gap in that feeling of being able to minister, whether to myself or just to the other, right? And this need to kind of bring those two together by following your teaching. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated these reminders, I think, and continuing to deepen the acceptance of this process of needing to silence my mind. And I was also curious. I found the two songs you chose to play very beautiful, that you sent us on the cherubim hymn, it was called. I was just curious if it had inspired you to play those, or maybe there was no reason or meaning to it. But
yeah, I think we only played one of them because time was short for that. Let me deal with your first question. the problem with ministering is that if you were not ministered to as a child properly, if you were not given the kind of attention and love that had the intention of raising you and developing your heart, your intelligence, your ability to function at a high level of your potentiality, and to develop your desire to grow and to learn and to excel and to bring out your inherent spiritual nobility and generosity and goodness and joy. If that wasn't given to you, then when the ego becomes fixed in its particular state, which happens after a few years in childhood, that program doesn't have in its repertoire the ministering function because it didn't receive it. And then it's much, much more difficult to achieve it later in life because if you didn't get that, there will be anti-life tendencies, there will be tendencies of anger and hatred and disappointment and desire to fight and flight away from others and to act in antisocial ways that are the opposite of ministering. But they are not under your control. They become autonomous behavior patterns that can't be controlled because that capacity for love has not been allowed to develop that can overcome them and soothe them. And that's why it's very helpful, I think, as a visitor, to enter into an energy field in which there is a lot of mutual ministering and acceptance and love and a role modeling of growth and of internalization and solitude and meditation and freedom. Being in such an energy field, then those capacities do tend to take root in the heart and gradually will emerge. And I have seen them emerge in you over time, and they're much more present than they were before. And I think you're not fully recognizing how much compassion and empathy and capacity to relate that you actually have, because the ego still has a facade of self putting down one's own capacities and of minimizing the aspects of the heart in favor of one's competence at the level of mind and of certain skill sets that you know are pragmatically useful to others. And there isn't that full appreciation that this is the part of you that will lead you into liberation and help you to be a teacher and a guide for others, and that that's the real primary function. All of those other things are necessary. They are skill sets that are essential, but they don't have to do with you. They have to do with the machine that you are operating. And as soon as you are able to disidentify from that, then the machine will become a machine not just of performance and of skill, but of divine ministering through love and through wisdom.
Which perhaps sounds a bit more like a cherub.
Exactly. And that's the reason we played the music, which is a kind of medieval Christmas music, although those pieces were by Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, I believe. But they are really renditions of very ancient modes of adoration of God.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, I think we're out of time for this evening. How many people got something out of this gathering? Yes, I'm glad to hear that. And I will try to... I've gotten a lot of the administering function complete, and I'll try to be with you more for the remainder of the retreat, and certainly for Christmas and then the New Year's retreat and all of that. And I will do my best to see all of the retreatants, some perhaps even before the retreat, and but everyone at least once. So I will do my best to call you at times when you're available and not in other classes. But I do look forward to meeting all of you individually and to... getting to know your real self and help you know your real self and to enjoy the freedom of our shared true nature, which is that of great bliss. Thank you all. Namaste.